Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Election Week here at the Damage Report. We're in day three, and things are really heating up, cooling down. I don't know. We're still in the election. Things are looking pretty good, but we're expecting breaking news at any moment. So today might be chaotic. It might be an end to a little bit of the chaos. We're going to have to hang in there and see. But one thing we do have going for us is that you're not just going to have to suffer through this hour with me. We've got a special guest for you joining us for the first time ever on the Damage Report. Malika Jabali, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So you've written for everyone, basically. For people who might not be familiar with our work, can you tell our audience a little bit about who you've reported for and written for?
Yeah, primarily I'm a Guardian columnist, so you can find me there twice a month or so. I've been doing election coverage for them for a little bit over a year, about a year and a half now. Prior to that, I wrote this piece called The Color of Economic Anxiety. That was actually an award-winning piece from the New York Association of Black Journalists. And it was kind of reframing the narrative about what we think about people with economic anxiety in the Midwest. And it was focusing on Black voters, which is actually very timely right now, considering that Wisconsin and Michigan flip to Joe Biden, given a lot of those people coming back out in urban districts.
Exactly. And so we're going to be talking about your reporting there. We're also going to be talking a little bit later on in the show, if we can get to it, about the Lincoln Project. And I think that's going to be an interesting dichotomy there about who theoretically the Democrats could be focusing their attention and time and fundraising dollars on. But anyway, definitely looking forward to that. Notice to the audience, we've got a full hour of news that we're going to be talking about, but there is also the possibility that at any time some big breaking election news can happen. We're expecting possible updates on the vote count in both Nevada and Georgia. I'm seeing that as of 10 minutes ago, Trump's lead in Georgia is now down to just 13,540 votes. Joe Biden's lead in Nevada is at about, I think, 11,500 votes. So we still have several states that could be incredibly important for determining the final electoral outcome that are very tight. And so if those happen, we will actually have a relatively special guest in the studio for you. So look forward to that. For those of you who might already be watching on YouTube or on Twitch, please remember to like the stream, share it, let people know that we're live. And while we're going, you can send us comments and tweets and super chats and all that, and we'll be responding as we go. And Malika, with that, why don't we launch into this thing? So there's chaos out there, and the prime agent of chaos would, of course, be Donald Trump, who is responding to the ongoing count by blurting crazy things into the void. And you know, I don't know how much we can ever learn from a Trump tweet. I do think that he's very bad at hiding his state of mind. And so it's possible that by looking at some of the way he's attempting to communicate with his followers, we can get an idea of what he thinks his chances are, at least in terms of winning the vote count. And so let's read the tea leaves a little bit. The first thing I saw was him tweeting, "Stop the count." So probably not a confidence move right there. Stop the count. He also tweeted very recently, "Stop the fraud," which I think he uses those words interchangeably. Fraud and count, he thinks that they're both not valid. Last night he had tweeted, "Any vote that came in after election day will not be counted." But that's not true. That's not how it actually works. It will actually be counted. So Malika, with Donald Trump, you know, like throwing matches onto this tense situation, what do you think his mood is? What do you think internal to the Trump campaign they think their chances are of continuing their lead in Pennsylvania and in Georgia, possibly flipping Nevada, the sort of thing that would be necessary for him to actually legitimately win an electoral college victory?
Well, you know, Donald Trump doesn't care anything about legitimacy. He's going to invent narratives and invent scenarios and talk about, you know, fake facts or whatever he wants to talk about. But the bottom line is that these are all legal scenarios. These are all legal operations that these vote counters have been committing, you know, hours and hours to making sure we actually somewhat live up to our promises of democracy. It's very clear where Donald Trump's state of mind is, because it's the state of mind he's had over the past 4 years. Even though he is in power, he still has a victim complex. Like he reminds me of a walking, breathing YouTube commentator. you know, it's not based on any facts. It's based on whatever's going on in his mind, a lot of fictions. And he's speaking to the YouTube commentary base. Yeah. Apologies for the folks who are commenting on YouTube. I comment on YouTube, but we know exactly who he's catering to with this.
Yeah, we've tried to do a good job of pruning our YouTube comments section to keep it as an actual productive environment. And people seem to enjoy it there. But yeah, he has that victim complex. His base is, it is maintaining in your mind simultaneously that you're the awesome, big, strong majority, and you are a victim of literally everything in your life. You are super powerful and awesome, and everybody is always being mean and unfair to you. And they've seemed to have learned even more of that from him. In terms of his legal challenges, because those are continuing, we've had a few updates on that this morning. In Pennsylvania, there had been a judge who ruled that they would be able to have Trump campaign observers in closer quarters with the vote count. That was almost immediately overturned by another judge right after Trump and his team had been claiming victory in that. You also have in Georgia, there had been an attempt to claim that one of the counties in Georgia had been counting votes that were cast after the cutoff point. A judge threw that out. But of course, that's not final. I mean, for any one of these, Malaika, presumably a higher court could again reverse it, even up to and including the Supreme Court, which in the run up to the election had, it was mixed messages, but they had seemed to be willing to, in some cases, make changes that would cut some votes from consideration.
Yeah, I mean, and that would completely undermine his whole message about stopping the count. So are we stopping the count or are we starting it? Are we reviewing the count or not? So, you know, I think that they're just trying to fight for and scramble for power, however it comes. Right now, Joe Biden is at 264 electoral votes without even looking at what may be some of the more contentious states without even having to touch Georgia. So I think once it's all said and done, Joe Biden is probably going to win. He's going to keep fighting the same way that he sues, you know, everyone that he sued in the past. So I'm not that concerned about Donald Trump other than the fact that it's going to create headlines and maybe be a distraction in terms of getting at the real policies that people are going to be expecting out of a Joe Biden administration.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and that those same people will probably end up being incredibly frustrated with Joe Biden's inability to deliver on it, whether he ends up getting the majority in the Senate or not, which is something we're going to be talking about a little bit later on. In terms of those legal challenges, obviously, for Joe Biden, in terms of taking the presidency, 270 is as good as 400. But with both the possibility of continued legal challenges and the possibility of faithless electors, because our democracy is literally insane, getting Georgia, getting Pennsylvania would certainly be nice. And the weird thing with Trump is that he always does this thing where he undercuts his legal challenges that are ongoing. Like he directly argues against the case that his lawyers are making. And we have an example of that from yesterday. Oh no, actually, well, we have two really, but we have one more recent one where he tweeted earlier, "Our lawyers have asked for meaningful access, but what good does that do? The damage has already been done to the integrity of our system and to the presidential election itself. This is what should be discussed." So no, but they're asking for that meaningful access in Pennsylvania this morning, and he's saying, "But who cares?" And look, I would argue the same thing. Look, if both campaigns want to watch the count, I guess that's a thing that can happen. It's unlikely to actually change the outcome. But what I'm getting from him is that I think he is not just retreating from the idea that he can win it outright from the votes. That seems to be an acknowledgement that he doesn't think he can win it based on the challenges they have in court right now. And so I don't know what if you were to retreat from that, I don't know what's left. I don't know if it's, you know, he knows he's gonna lose, but he wants to maintain plausible deniability about how awesome he is so that his base will follow him to whatever the next step is. Or if this is, you know, we're not gonna win just by having people watch the vote. We need the Supreme Court to invalidate, you know, a million votes in Pennsylvania or something like that. I don't know. It's a weird thing to do while your lawyers are pleading the case for you to undercut their core argument.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to how serious he really even is about having lawyers involved. It seems to me, because just based on Donald Trump's history, that this is like probably as much as a dog whistle to incite exactly what we're seeing right now in terms of riling up his base to keep harassing, you know, the election officials in Nevada and Pennsylvania and Georgia and elsewhere. Because if, you know, he's really concerned about having meaningful access, like it seems bizarre that he would then throw up his hand and say, well, maybe not. When you have journalists, the New York Times was in Wisconsin. I mean, you see reporters inside of these buildings already watching over the people who are making these counts. So what exactly is the barrier here? So I'm not exactly sure that this is a complete, that Donald Trump is really trying to frame a legitimate argument that's actually logical, as opposed to just riling up his base with baseless assumptions in order to do what he's always done, which is to create chaos.
Exactly, exactly. Look, I agree with you about the process that's ongoing, but of course, from the point of view of his base, which I guess is 30 to 44% of the country, those reporters being there, that makes it worse. Reporters like from the New York Times, like you, you're fake news, according to them. They believe some rando commentator on Breitbart, to them, has more credibility. Don Jr. has more credibility than someone like you who works for The Guardian. It's crazy pants, but that's what they believe. And we have to remember, all of us, that as this goes forward, everybody is clicking constantly to get new news, but they're not clicking on the same places. Like, you know, I might be looking to see what the official count is for Nevada and Georgia. Others are looking at 4chan, or they're looking at Drudge, or they're looking at some Discord, or they're looking at that rapidly expanding Stop the Count Facebook page. And so no matter what ends up actually happening with the final count in the Electoral College, you're gonna have a significant portion of the population that doesn't necessarily believe that it's legitimate. Which to me going forward is a little bit scary. Regardless of what happens with Trump, his base is not going to accept that he lost if he in fact does actually lose, which is not guaranteed, but seems pretty likely at this point.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that. That's absolutely correct. That's what we're probably going to see. I mean, again, they had this sort of victim complex even when Donald Trump did win. You saw a continuous rise in like these white nationalist far right militias that were attacking people. You saw a rise in sort of conspiracy theories where like folks like Cesar Sayoc who were trying to take Democratic officials out. And again, well, not again, but I haven't mentioned this, but you know, I'm not aligned with either party. This is not to defend Democrats in any way whatsoever. But we are seeing more violence coming from the far right, even when they are in positions of authority, even when they have won. So we are definitely going to see that post-Trump, if that is what's going to happen.
That is my fear.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
With the vote still so close in multiple states, protest groups were active in Detroit, they were active in Phoenix, and it's possible that more are coming. because really dangerous individuals like Harlan Hill are tweeting things like, I'm going to Philly tomorrow with a team. This is war. This is war. This is war. But the first shot was actually fired in the war when friend of the show Ken Klippenstein did what he did best, which is just show the tweet and then show the profile pic. And I think Harlan Hill was just buried. It's war. Oh my God. Look, we shouldn't laugh because, of course, for every Harlan Hill, there's a group of Oath Keepers or Proud Boys. And those are obviously the people that we do have to worry about. But it is a little bit funny when the threat of militia or domestic terrorist violence is also being muddied with right-wing grifters who are generally tweeting things like, I've never had such a bad experience becoming a new customer of a company. Comcast needs to step it up. I'll blog about this tomorrow. That was the true war, the war on Comcast. But anyway, so in addition to Harlan Hill, you do, as we said, you do have the crowds. Like here's a crowd of people in Arizona. Admittedly, it's not a huge crowd, but Malaika, I just think it's funny that they are right outside a place where the votes are being counted, chanting to count the vote. They are. That's what they're doing right now. I don't understand it as a strategy. Does it make any sense to you?
Well, of course not. And I think these are folks who are bored. I think they saw the, you know, legitimate grievances and concerns of people who are responding to Black Lives Matter. And some of the Antifa and, you know, the anti-fascist protests in Portland, and they need to come up with a grievance too. So, yeah. You know, if they're going to be protesting outside of Ben and Jerry's to open up Ben and Jerry's, or they're going to be in their golf carts to, you know, to protest wearing masks, and that's what they're going to do. We're still in lockdown. Well, some of us are in lockdown and trying to, you know, obey some of these stay-at-home orders wherever they may be. And folks are bored. So, you know, I think on one hand, like you said, it's somewhat entertainment, but where does it cross the line into something being more sinister than that, where now they're going to be armed and they're going to go to Black communities and go to Black precincts? I'm actually in Wisconsin right now, whereas we know in Kenosha, Wisconsin, about 45 minutes south of where I am in Milwaukee, you had somebody like Hal Rittenhouse who wanted to protect property. And through protecting property, yeah, obviously he's saying that this takes priority over the lives of people who are protesting police violence. So, you know, I think it is, it's laughable, it's a joke. And we also have to be concerned about when it does cross that line into something that is more violent than that. And you know, it speaks to a larger issue of people feeling this sense of status threat and feeling like people are taking over, even if it's, you know, white allies in Black Lives Matter protests. Yeah. And they have to exert that some kind of way. And it is disconcerting that there is such a, you know, a critical mass of people who do feel like this. And it's like they're in an alternate universe.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right about the entertainment. I mean, you know, remember the Tea Party protest supposedly over the national debt? That was a thing that they supposedly cared about, but they really just want an opportunity to dress up like our founders and lounge around in chairs and stuff. But I hope that they don't do some of the protests that you just mentioned, because if they do start protesting Ben and Jerry's, it might muddy the waters from my ongoing protests against Ben and Jerry's for canceling the cinnamon buns flavor. I will never forgive them for that.
Buns flavor?
They canceled it.
They shouldn't have canceled it. You had to protest harder. I didn't even know that was a thing.
I know. And they tried to gaslight me. I tweeted about it and they tweeted back that they hadn't canceled it. It's in their flavor graveyard. Check your website, Ben and Jerry's, seriously. But anyway, I am worried about the possibility for violence. You know, the Oath Keepers were on Alex Jones the week before the election, saying that they were ready to start gunning people down. And let's bear in mind, as you just acknowledged, that if they do, they're not going around the country trying to block the votes of people like me, even though they should because I'm a hardcore leftist. But no, they're going to Detroit, they're going to Philadelphia, they're probably gonna be in Atlanta. It is generally Black votes that they want to see stopped. Coincidentally, they always just have a problem with these cities voting. And I am very worried that at some point it's going to go beyond banging on the glass. If they think that Trump has lost, that it's done, I don't know exactly what they're going to do. I know that outside of in Arizona where we were showing that protest, supposedly the people doing the count were trying to come up with a strategy for going home after their shift because they were so worried about walking out to their cars when the place is surrounded by those crowds that could theoretically get violent. But thus far, the cops are being very nice to them. They don't seem to have a problem with those protests, which is a striking difference from some of the other protests you were talking about earlier in the show.
Yeah, I mean, we see that double standard throughout history. So, of course, you know, this is nothing new when you look at just even peaceful civil rights protests from the 50s through 60s. You had a disproportionate response from police authorities, law enforcement officials. And so this is the same thread. This is the same kind of alliance where you had, you know, Ku Klux Klan members who were in police departments. So it's the same sort of alliance of kind of white nationalism and far right reactionaries who are in, you know, in bed with police officials, or they are themselves police officials, where they're allowing this type of behavior to occur. And a lot of Black people are already familiar with this. Anyone who's familiar with the history of policing and protests in this country is familiar with this. So I think the step for organizers is to just be prepared, to be aware that this is a possibility, that this is a threat, and then figure out a strategy how to deal with it. And as I mentioned, since I am in Milwaukee, part of my work has been shadowing organizers who are voter guardians. And so they are prepared to call up some other organizers if there needed to be a way to de-escalate violence at some of the polls. Fortunately, our polling location was calmer. You know, the polling location that I was reporting at was calm, and there weren't any obvious threats. But there's also police surveillance of those polling locations. So they're even doing the work of some of these, you know, the people who are overtly and explicitly associated with the reactionary right. You have police officers who are going to these polling locations where you have Black organizers and harassing them repeatedly. So, you know, they're kind of, you know, a lot of them are overlapping groups, and some of them are probably friends and associates.
Yeah, and we've certainly seen a ton of evidence of that. I mean, we were talking about Kenosha, that was very clear, videos very well documenting the overlap there, but we've seen it in Portland, we've seen it in a number of cities. Very scary, and as we're looking to the possibility of civil unrest, possibly violence, depending on what happens in the next couple of days, I would be very worried about that. Malaika, you've been doing a lot of reporting around right now. You're in the Midwest, and we've now got, assuming nothing is flipped, and it doesn't seem like for these states it will be, but that Wisconsin has gone back for the Dems. You have Michigan, where Joe Biden in the end will have won with a much larger margin than Donald Trump had back in 2016. Tell me a little bit about that, and what do you think it represents, and what lessons we should learn from those states flipping back blue?
Well, for one, I think it underscores the logical fallacy that Joe Biden has been riding on, that he needs to win back Trump voters, and he needs to win over centrists and conservatives and cater policy toward them. I think he felt that he needed to align with Lincoln Republicans, people like Rick Snyder, for instance, who poisoned or oversaw the cover up of poisoned water in Flint. And there were absolutely no convictions that were involved with any of those officials who were involved in that. And these are the types of Republicans that Joe Biden has aligned himself with just to say that he was able to reach across the aisle. And so Joe Biden has actually been winning these states in spite of himself, in spite of the fact that he did very little organizing, in spite of the fact that he has not presented or at least campaigned hard on economic policy that can improve the lives of people across race, working class voters who have been decimated by deindustrialization, despite the fact that he frankly added somebody who is a pro-cop prosecutor to his ticket. In spite of all these mistakes, he's winning because there is such a strong, if you talk to most people on the ground here, or a lot of Black folks, working class people, folks of color on the ground, there is such a strong anti-Trump sentiment that you could have put like a non-sentient being in Joe Biden's election, they probably would have defeated Donald Trump. And the fact that it is so close speaks to the weaknesses of that strategy, because after a pandemic where you had nearly a quarter of a million people die, it has to come down to nail biters in a handful of states. But he should thank his lucky stars that we are in the crisis that we're in, and that you have black voters who are just so tired, and other voters of color who are just so tired of Donald Trump, that they're willing to drag their feet to get this man over the line when he can barely help himself, and he creates so many unforced errors.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, we don't have finalized votes and all of that, but it looks like, I think I saw sort of anecdotally, the black female vote was 93% for Joe Biden, I think I saw, and 7% for Trump. I saw a breakdown of the youth vote. And whether you're talking about black voters, Latino voters, Asian voters, very heavily in favor of Joe Biden, despite, I think it's fair to say, not a lot done during the campaign to produce that outcome. And I have a fear. Let me know what you think about this. So you have these different philosophies about what needs to be done during the elections. You have the Lincoln Project with all their money and whatever. Let's get a few of these. Let's get John Kasich's cousin to vote for Joe Biden or whatever. And then you have people who say, you know, like they were saying during the primaries, that we need to value the black vote. We need to prioritize it and all of that. My fear is that Joe Biden didn't do that, but that a lot of the resistance-y types are gonna think that he did, because the vote came out the way it did. And they love to say, you know, they'll say things like, you know, Stacey Abrams is a goddess or whatever. But they don't seem to be demanding that Joe Biden really have that perspective or that prioritization be reflective in his policies. It seems to me like this might sort of be a worst case scenario where the vote came through for him. It was both loyal and effective in flipping these states. And a lot of white liberals are gonna think, oh, we did what we're supposed to do. But in terms of policy, they didn't really. So where does that leave these communities and whatever they might want out of Joe Biden going forward, assuming he becomes president?
I think it's going to be very challenging, and I think that is a concern. You're going to have some liberal commentators who are going to co-opt what's been happening in the Midwest and say that, well, you know, black people came through for Joe, and they're only going to focus on the outcome and not the fact that you had a lot of grumblings on the ground where people said, I didn't want Joe Biden, I just needed Trump out. And so I think that message is going to get lost. I think it's going to help reinforce the idea that the Democratic Party elite can take a lot of these black voters and working class voters for granted. And it might lead to him creating policy positions that fill cabinet positions with people who do not align with the working class whatsoever. I think he's going to be looking at Republican picks. I think he's going to be looking at more centrist picks. He's going to be looking at corporate picks to fill his cabinet. And we're not really going to be able to get at the issues that cause, you know, kind of the reluctant support for Joe Biden in the first place. In a state like Wisconsin, for instance, if you look at the city of Milwaukee, it's 40% black, 40. That is a higher percentage than the black population in Brooklyn, in Houston, in neighboring Chicago. And they also happen to have the highest black male incarceration rate in the country. They happen to have the highest disparity in COVID death rates between blacks and whites in the country. They happen to have some of the highest income inequality and wealth inequality in the country. So I'm concerned that we're still not going to be able to get at the issues that led to a lot of black people feeling disaffected in places like Wisconsin and Michigan. And just for the record, the Midwest has the worst disparities of any other region in the country when it comes to black socioeconomic indicators between the black community here and white constituents in the region. And so that is a very strong concern of mine as a, you know, as a journalist, but also as an activist. I do organizing work. And so I think it's really going to come down to not really what can Joe Biden do for these communities, but what can these communities do for themselves in spite of Joe Biden? Yeah. What can they do locally with abolition and with some of the economic justice work that is already going on here?
Yeah, no, I think those are great points. And so if people want to see more of your reporting, which touches on a lot of aspects of what you just talked about, they should go to The Guardian, correct?
I've done a lot of work for The Guardian about the black Midwest. But I also did a short film. I produced a short film where I talked about this economic crisis facing black Midwesterners. You can go to YouTube. It's called Left Out. And if you want to just have a short link, it's bit.ly/leftout2020.
Awesome. Thank you. We don't know for sure what's going to happen with the presidential race. Stay tuned. Maybe we'll find out later on today. But if Joe Biden does end up winning, we don't know what the Senate is going to look like either. And at least in the short term, it looks like there's a good chance that Mitch McConnell, of all people, will still be in control. And apparently, that might put a lot of pressure on Joe Biden to do things that I, as a leftist, fear he kind of wants to do anyway. So let's talk a little bit about some of this reporting that's been done by Axios. They're saying Republicans' likely hold on the Senate is forcing Joe Biden's transition team to consider limiting its prospective cabinet nominees to those who Mitch McConnell can live with, according to people familiar with the matter. The new Senate political math could dash the ambitions of some Democrats, including those who've clashed with Republicans. So what would this look like? A source close to McConnell tells Axios a Republican Senate would work with Biden on centrist nominees, but no radical progressives or ones who are controversial with conservatives. The Biden agenda would be severely restricted by GOP control. Quote, it's going to be armed camps. And so what are some examples of people that they would not be okay with? Well, obviously, they're not interested in Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. But I have also heard that people like Stacey Abrams was in the reporting I saw that they're not interested in her being involved in the cabinet in any way. I'm sure it's just because they think she's a hardcore communist or whatever. They don't have any other problems with her. But anyway, Mitch McConnell is apparently going to be trying to limit who can actually get confirmed to be on his cabinet. Malika, my fear is that I don't think Joe Biden has any interest in Warren or Bernie being on his cabinet anyway. And so I fear that this is sort of an excuse for him to do with what he normally wants to do anyway, which is probably get some old establishment Democrats, some Wall Street picks and things like that. How do you see this shaking out if Mitch McConnell is still in charge of the Senate?
That's the concern for me too. I think this is just, it's just handed to Joe Biden that it's something that is pretty convenient for a way that he's already governed and the way that he's already implemented policy over the last, I don't know, about 40 years or 50 years of his career. So I think that this is incredibly convenient for him. Democrats had the same sort of excuses, even when Barack Obama had, held to two houses. So I think that it's going to just play into the way that Joe Biden has already done politics. And I think what his fundamental ideology is, I do not think that he's a liberal. I don't even think he's a centrist. I think he is a conservative who just is less explicitly racist than Republicans are prone to be. And I mean, and he's still very racist in a lot of his rhetoric and the way that he talks about poor black communities and low income communities. But I think he's just been able to find a home in the Democratic Party because they're less explicitly so. So if you even go back to some of his commentary or that of his advisors, and this is in the middle of a pandemic where there's likely going to be a recession, there's already extensive unemployment. He was already telling Wall Street Journal reporters, or I should say his administration was, that they are probably going to be unlikely to pay for any of the progressive policies that they have been, hitching their wagon onto over the last several months to try and get progressives and radicals into the Democratic tent to make sure that they came out and voted for him. So we can just go to his own statements, the statements of his own advisors, that this is something that they weren't interested in before any of these Senate races.
Yeah. Yeah, if we're at the point, and we don't know for sure it's gonna go this way, we're gonna talk in a little bit about some of the runoffs that might change this, the math here. But if we're at the point where McConnell is effectively talking about you can't even have cabinet picks that you want or that you pretend to want at the very least, I'm assuming at that point we can forget about legislation. We can forget about potentially stimulus for COVID. He's pretending that he wants it. We'll talk about that too. If a Supreme Court seat opens up in year one or year two, do we have any reason to believe that Mitch McConnell is going to ever have a hearing for that? I mean, are we effectively looking at not just, Obama era, there's a filibuster on literally every bill, but now we're talking about no Supreme Court, no judges below the level of the Supreme Court, no cabinet members. Are they gonna hold up like the naming of post offices and stuff like that? Is literally anything gonna get done between now and 2024 if Mitch McConnell's still in charge?
Right. It's hard to see this presidency with Joe Biden being super effective. And so I think that tells us two things. I think one is that you have to listen to progressives and organizers before there's an election season. The fact that people consolidated power around somebody who was relatively unpopular. If you look at the polling around enthusiasm for Joe Biden, it was like much lower than, I mean, it was lower than it was even for Hillary Clinton. And so the fact that the Democratic Party consolidated power around somebody who many people were reluctant to vote for, it means that people were also saying, okay, well, we might need to think about getting Trump out, but what is step two in terms of actually getting, what do we want? So we know what we don't want, but what do we want? What policies, what vision is this party going to be about? And if you are not rallying support around policy, around a vision, you're going to get folks who might feel lackluster about, and you're also going to have Senate candidates, the DCCC, for instance, who are going to be promoting candidates who are not visionary, who are not progressive in any way. And so you're not going to have the support that you even need for a Biden presidency if you think that, okay, well, suddenly he's now going to be progressive, even if you just take that at face value. How is he going to implement any of that if you do not have enough support down ballot? And that's precisely what we're seeing right now. And so, you know, that's the first thing, is the fact that this probably could have been avoided if they went for somebody that people were a little bit more excited about. But secondly, you also have to maybe reframe what it means to be progressive, what it means to be radical. I'm a socialist, so I don't really even identify as a progressive, but for people who do, what do you do in the next 4 years? So I think the thinking has to go from, okay, well, let's just keep talking about the senators and the federal administration being hypocritical, to what do we do in light of that? What can people do at a local level? What can they do at a state level? What can they do with city budgets? And figure out how to implement more of a local strategy where it's probably going to be more effective over the next 4 years.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that that's very wise. And, you know, I think Mitch McConnell's threat here, I think it's actually very useful. Let's say that hypothetically Mitch McConnell does stay in charge of the Senate. You have Biden sworn in, and now he's facing this threat where Mitch McConnell's like, no, you can only have, like, you know, the CEO of Goldman Sachs in charge. That's the only person we're gonna confirm. I think this is almost good for us as people viewing Biden to get an idea of what he's gonna do over the next 4 years, because he could very easily just appoint acting cabinet heads. He could have whoever he wants. He could give Elizabeth Warren, you know, labor if that's what she wants. I don't necessarily understand why she'd want to leave the Senate, but let's say that she does, and she seems to. He could give it to her. He gives Stacey Abrams a position. He could just do it. He could do that. If he doesn't do that, knowing that he can, I think that sends a pretty strong signal to us about what he's willing to fight on and what he's not. And I would argue that what he's willing to fight on is nothing, like literally nothing over the next 4 years. So that's gonna be depressing, but I think it will be instructive. And we should remember that while we do need to fight during presidential elections, that is necessary. We also need to fight, much more importantly, during primaries. And I would say even before that, we need to fight to get the right people to run the primaries. There are a million battles that need to be waged simultaneously. Very few of them directly have to do with Joe Biden or, going forward, Kamala Harris the next time around. You know, the squad was expanded, or will be expanded, going into this next congressional session because people didn't focus exclusively on the presidential race. And they did find good people, activists at the ground level, to run these races. And maybe they didn't even win the first time. Maybe it was like Cori Bush, but eventually they continue to back them, and now they're going to be exerting at least some influence over the party going forward. So yeah, a little bit depressing looking forward, but we'll see. We'll see. Anything else you want to say about Biden interacting with a majority leader, Mitch McConnell?
Sure. I think just the last thought in terms of where he is, he's already said that he's fighting for normalcy and civility. This is a man who found normalcy and civility with Strom Thurmond, who was a staunch segregationist. So this plays again right into Joe Biden's existing way of doing things and worldview. He's tweeted about the fact that we need to be able to accept our enemies or not view, you know, the opposition as enemies. And that is a completely, I think, backwards and I don't even know if I would say naive. I think this is intentional and allowing him to relinquish any sort of fight for true progressive legislation.
Yeah, you know who should be saying stuff like that? Gap. I don't know if people saw their tweet about the red and the blue shirt. It was like half red, half blue. And they're like, hey, we can all wear the colors or whatever. Like, no, shut up, Gap. Shut up. Seriously, shut up. We're trying to do something important here. But yeah, Biden's like, they're going to have an awakening and they're going to be, no, dude, they're not going to give you anything. They hate your guts, you moron. Seriously, he seems like a nice guy. But no, they hate you. And the talk about civility and normality, no, their normality isn't normal, their civility isn't civil. It's not, it's good for them, they like it, they've benefited from it, they want to continue to benefit from it. But the people who are hurting right now don't need to go back to 2015. 2015 sucked in a million different ways, some less than the last few years, but they still sucked. I hope that people don't forget that.
Right, he's bringing finger guns to an AR-15 fight. So we just gotta be prepared for that.
He is. And Jim Carrey, not just the Jim Carrey version. Him as well. I hope not. Dude, Biden, you have been trying to become president for like 40 years now. Use it for something, You wasted a half a life doing this. If you finally get it, use it for something good. Come on, pick a fight. Pretend they're corn pop, man. Pretend the GOP is corn pop and fight like you would have back when you were supporting the segregationists openly. God.
Right. No, he'd rather AOC, so you know.
I know. Well, if it comes down to that, I know who I'm siding with. So based on the way the numbers are looking today, we are going to have a couple of runoffs coming in the next couple of months. Both of them in Georgia, and they will be instrumental in trying to figure out who is actually going to control the Senate. So with two runoffs happening in the same state, if you live in Georgia, don't turn on your TV for the next few months because it is just gonna be political ads. They're gonna spend $1 billion on you. But that said, some of the ads are already coming out and I'm kind of enjoying them. Here is one ad trying to get in front of the attack ads that are to come.
Raphael Warnock eats pizza with a fork and knife. Raphael Warnock once stepped on a crack in the sidewalk. Raphael Warnock even hates puppies.
Get ready, Georgia. The negative ads are coming. Kelly Loeffler doesn't want to talk about why she's for getting rid of healthcare in the middle of a pandemic, so she's going to try and scare you with lies about me. I'm Raphael Warnock, and I approve this message because I'm staying focused on what Washington could do for you. And by the way, I love puppies.
I like that ad. Maybe I like pizza and I like puppies, so maybe he's pandering to me, I don't know. But I thought that was pretty good. And so that's Raphael Warnock. He finished first on Tuesday in a 20 candidate field. Kelly Loeffler, current incumbent, who finished second. They're gonna have that runoff. It's gonna be Warnock versus Loeffler on January 5th. So we know a good bit now about Kelly Loeffler, what she did during the pandemic, whose interests she was looking out for. What do you think about that race going forward and the fact that we're now apparently, based on what we're seeing from Perdue and Ossoff, gonna have dueling runoff elections in Georgia?
I think it speaks to something that I was kind of implying earlier about the importance of these more like statewide, you know, even it's a federal race, but there is a little bit more room to have, and I wouldn't consider Reverend Warnock a progressive per se, probably leans more towards liberal, like he's interested in sort of the traditional Democratic Party platforms of expanding on ACA and Medicaid expansion, which is important. But you know, for Georgia, I think there's only so far that he could go, but I think the viability of his campaign, the fact that he led, and by the way, I am a native of Georgia. I've attended, he's a reverend of, or the reverend of Ebenezer Baptist Church, where that used to be Martin Luther King's former church. That was a church that he like presided at during his civil rights campaigns. And I've been there, you know, so I've heard Reverend Warnock preach during his MLK services. My mom has taken me frequently to the MLK services. And so I know from his rhetoric that he is, you know, attempting to speak for a lot of these working class and these working class voters who are in Georgia. And there's only so much that, you know, he can do to really push the needle. But the fact that he has done so well in a red state shows the viability of some of these local elections if you actually engage black voters. I haven't looked at the election data, but I'm pretty sure that he's relying on a lot of the kind of work that Stacey Abrams did. And when you look at her campaign, where she almost won the gubernatorial race in a red state, a deep red state, where, you know, you have somebody like Kemp, Brian Kemp, who's, you know, refusing that people could wear a mask, and where the state has often fought with city officials about that, which is predominantly black. The fact that he's done so well, I think, is important. And we have to look at the importance of ground game organizing. Stacey Abrams went to rural communities, and rural communities in a lot of places in Georgia are filled with rural black voters who were not engaged before because people thought that they were a lost cause or they're erased in some way. And there was a lot of work done consistently for years to get them out. And so, you know, it's not just about kind of putting a black face in a high place. You also have to speak to their issues. And Warnock, I think, has done that to a, you know, an acceptable degree.
Yeah. No, that's awesome that you've actually been there and heard his sermons. That's amazing. Joe Biden, we were talking about earlier, didn't necessarily prioritize the black vote. You know, I had Chuck Roach on multiple times through the course of the election to try to plead to him to do something in terms of listening to the concerns of various Latino communities and what they're interested in and all that. So, but now these runoffs aren't gonna be explicitly about Joe Biden quite as much. You're gonna have Warnock and Ossoff trying to get people to vote. I think it's likely that Stacey Abrams will probably be involved with that. Now, the way that Joe Biden could be involved is whether Joe Biden delivers anything could hinge on how those runoff elections go. From the Republican point of view, they're gonna put as much resource into that as possible to stop Biden from doing literally anything. But I would have to imagine that Joe Biden will go in campaign because he needs those seats. If Donald Trump has lost at that point and accepts that he's lost, I don't think he gives a damn what happens in Georgia or what happens to Senate Republicans. I don't know that he'll necessarily go there and do rallies and everything. So with all of that and additional context that you can provide, what do you think about the Dems' chances of winning one or both of those races come January?
I mean, to be frank, I have kind of a limited, I've looked at this in a limited capacity, looking at the Georgia Senate races, but just from kind of being familiar with Ossoff's campaign previously where he lost, I think that there is going to be some energy around, I think there's gonna be some energy around, you know, the electoral arm of getting, you know, more of a liberal or progressive agenda in Congress. I think people were probably a little bit, I mean, you had high voter turnout in 2018, but I think people are gonna be more energized because of the time that we're in right now, again, where you can get somebody like Joe Biden who has not spoken to any of these concerns in an adequate degree, where you still have very high turnout. I think it's just going to depend on people's turnout. And I do think that they both have relatively strong chances. We are also aware that Georgia is prone to voter suppression. This is an issue that I faced growing up in Georgia, where I had some of my first opportunities to vote. It was very clear that more liberal counties had experienced bouts of voter suppression. Even when I voted for Barack Obama in 2008, I was, you know, a spry, you know, right before we got like all the brunt of the Great Recession and had all this hope. You know, we have hour long lines voting for Barack Obama. So Georgia is prone to these kind of shenanigans. And so I just hope that there is a strong apparatus. But as far as you're answering your question, I know I can be long winded. As far as answering your question, I do think that there are strong chances for them given the state of politics right now and the fact that people are energized.
Yeah, potentially. I'm worried about the suppression as well. Obviously, in that 2018 Kemp Abrams race seemed pretty seem pretty important in determining that outcome. And I agree with you about Kemp's stance on COVID. I mean, I think he said, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, feel free to fact check it, everybody watching this, but I think about a month into the pandemic after the lockdowns, he said something about being surprised that, wait, people without symptoms can spread the disease. He hadn't known that, like a month in. We will never know how many extra lives were lost because we had Kemp instead of Abrams as the governor of that state, but it's a number greater than zero, unfortunately. Maybe with these runoffs, we'll have an opportunity to right that a little bit. But assuming that Biden wins, assuming Trump eventually concedes, the eyes of the nation will go to Georgia. And I think a gargantuan sum of money is going to be spent over the next 2 months there. It is going to be amazing to watch. Now,
to see Georgia become, potentially away from the stronghold. You know, Newt Gingrich is from Georgia. We had, I don't know if you guys remember this guy. I mean, it was Johnny Isaacson. I don't know if y'all remember him, but we've had some like really far right extreme folks who set the stage for some of the like delusional far right, the normalization of this far right ideology that we're seeing right now. So I'm looking forward to at least loosening that stranglehold, until it can become, even more far left than I would, prefer.
Well, I think it becoming more far left, that'd be great. Seems like it's going that direction. Not being delusional, that's going to be a little bit tougher. Of course, at least one QAnon candidate won in Georgia, another lost but was running. And even Kemp, I mean, he was the guy with the campaign ads of him trying to scare away a guy who was trying to date his daughter with a shotgun. Like, American politics is trippy, man. So while we're all focused on what's going on in Nevada and Georgia and Pennsylvania and other states, bear in mind that the pandemic is, it's just rampaging unchecked across this country. Take a look at the most recent reporting as of yesterday. States reported 1.1 million tests and 87,000 cases. 50,000 people are currently hospitalized with COVID-19. Sorry, this is actually from the third. The fourth, if I remember correctly, has a death toll of over 1,100 and 103,000 cases at least as of the COVID tracking project. Different trackers are gonna have different numbers, but what we do know is that we have more cases than have ever been registered before. And most seem to agree that we're now at over 100,000 with hospitalizations and deaths rising. If you take a look at this, you're gonna see the rise there in the cases. It is now going up to above that second peak that we saw. And we know what effect that has on hospitalizations, and we know inevitably what's gonna happen with deaths. So Malaika, it's happening now. I mean, we're sort of distracted politically, but it is just rampaging across so many different states right now.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder a couple of things. One, if there's going to be a point where a lot of government officials just say, this is just the way things are, that we just kind of accept this as the status quo. So to what extent will we have to sort of just live life just knowing that we're always going to have COVID? And it also makes me wonder how effective a presidency can be, because Joe Biden campaigned on being more effective than Donald Trump at managing the pandemic. But so much of this is due to people responding to their state officials. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's only so much that a president can have influence over when it comes to this. Yes, I think symbolically Donald Trump should be wearing a mask. But if you have people who are so committed to, for instance, being anti-vaccines or conspiracy theories, and they already have this whole community where they are anti-authoritarian or anti-authority or whatever, How successful can Joe Biden actually be? So I'm concerned that this is just going to be the way that we live from now on. And it's really, I wouldn't even say I'm embarrassed as an American. America has, done so much heinous stuff over the past years of its existence that this is just another reflection of that. But it should give, I think, a lot of Americans some pause as to what are the underlying cultural forces where people are so individualistic that we cannot manage something that most of the world has been able to at least cooperate in managing.
Yeah.
Despite, you know, us saying that we're, you know, this sort of excellency narrative. It's disconcerting.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we're seeing these numbers as I think yesterday Australia had zero community transmitted cases of COVID, I think, for the first time. So some states can do it. It's a different situation in Australia, clearly, but and then at the same time, we're seeing someone in the Twitch comments, I think Trashy Plays says, reminded us that in Denmark, COVID mutated to affect the mink population and then transfer back to humans. I think they're gonna cull 17 million mink as a result of that. And I agree. Look, I think the symbolism does matter to some extent. I think that having a president who's not gonna be constantly interfering with the CDC is important too. There's some stuff that you can do via executive order. But in terms of some big spending bill that does something about COVID, I don't know that Mitch McConnell's ever gonna allow it. I think that Republicans starting January 20th are gonna try to, and Fox is gonna back up, a strategy of doing two things. One, pretending to care more about the deaths, which is good, you should care about the deaths. But two, block anything being done to actually do anything about it. Like if Joe Biden tries to do some sort of national mask mandate, I think the Supreme Court is gonna knock it down and Fox News is gonna put pressure on them to do that. I think that it's better to have Biden clearly, but without a Democratic Senate, I think next year could still end up being very devastating when it comes to this pandemic.
Yeah, and I don't know, and I think you raise a really good point in terms of the fact that people need some economic incentives to stay home. So yes, people are individualistic and selfish, and Americans are, you know, into NIMBYism and protecting their rights and comparing wearing a mask to, you know, having like slave, you know, slavery shackles on them. But at the same time, you also have a lot of people who can't afford to stay home, who are essential workers, who have to, you know, somewhere like New York, where there are strong stay-at-home provisions, and we have a governor who, in some ways, is trying to control it, where you still have really high rates of this and high death rates because people have to go to work and they're in public places trying to do that and giving them more COVID exposure. Yeah. So without having a federal government who is committed to that, and again, even before we had concerns about the Senate races, you had Joe Biden saying that he doesn't know if he could pay for any of these things and that he'll be willing to pay for these things through large wealth transfers. So it remains to be seen, but I'm not optimistic.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're out there, if you're in America and you're watching, please do take this seriously. You know, if Joe Biden, if it's called for Joe Biden or something, that has literally nothing to do with whether or not you still need to wear your mask, socially distance and all that. That's still very much a threat and really all over the place. Notice to the director, I'm gonna jump ahead just a little bit here, but the 7-day average for new cases hit record highs in 20 different states, spanning every region of the country, with the largest increases in Colorado, Maine, Minnesota and Iowa. Three states, Kansas, New Mexico and Wyoming, also reported their highest daily fatality counts. So this is not just, oh, it's kind of getting bad again. It's getting bad all over. It's getting recordly bad in a number of different states. And this is what it looks like when you're on the path to that dark winter that Fauci and Biden were talking and all about and that sort of thing. There is a possibility that, especially combined with colder temperatures that drive people indoors and the flu, that we are going to have a very dark winter indeed. And remember, even if Biden does become president, it is months until he's able to start doing anything. And I don't see from Donald Trump any reason to believe that in a lame duck session, he's gonna suddenly care more about the pandemic than he has in the run-up to his reelection. I just don't see that happening. Now,
true, I have nothing to add to that.
Sure, I mean, sorry, it's depressing. Here is something amazing that we are seeing apparently from the early election returns, which again aren't final, But take a look at this. The president actually performed better this year than he did in 2016 in counties with high COVID-19 death rates, according to an internal analysis from Reuters. Trump made a 4% jump in votes, increasing from 50.1% in 2016 to 54.1% in 2020 in areas highly impacted by the coronavirus. He also won the majority of votes in states with the highest COVID-19 death rates, including Florida and Texas. Florida, by the way, where I lost a family member, not just being affected by the lack of leadership by Donald Trump, but also by Ron DeSantis, who hasn't issued a statewide mask mandate since COVID-19 hit back in March. Ron DeSantis didn't even seem to appear to know how to put on a mask as of several months ago. And he is a Trump bootlicker, if there ever was one. It's possible that without Trump, Ron DeSantis maybe would have done something, pretended to care about the pandemic, but he didn't, and it didn't seem to matter because Donald Trump, he actually rose in the vote count, even though he lost supporters to the pandemic. Like literally, they're dead now. He's doing better. So Malaika, I've been sort of wanting to talk briefly about this since the election. I think the fact that the pandemic didn't sink Trump is maybe one of the most amazing things in an election ever. Like what a coup by Fox News that his base didn't care. Like we lost 230,000 plus people. We're losing more now than we were 2 months ago. And it doesn't appear to have hurt him. In fact, in some areas, it seems like somehow it helped him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is consistent to how things work with the Republican Party, though, where we already know that. I mean, and it's, and I think it's important too to make some distinctions, because I think you have some people who might just be anti-establishment, and they see Donald Trump as an anti-establishment figure, where they think that any sort of government infringement into their lives is like worthy of a conspiracy, like a conspiracy theory, mm-hmm. or that it is, you know, an infringement of, you know, their constitutional rights and liberties. And so I think you have some folks who are less well off, who are just kind of going with the flow based on their belief that government is corrupted and Donald Trump is, you know, an outsider still. I think you also have a lot of Republicans who benefit. So I would be very interested in the data on who exactly supported him, because if you look at Donald Trump's support, he has gained, or not necessarily gained, but he has more support amongst people who make $100,000 or more mm-hmm. over Joe Biden. So it could also be a scenario where you have people who are in those communities, and they're in those counties where they're Republican, but they're not necessarily the ones who are making $100,000 and more, who just want to open up business because those are their businesses. Yeah. Those are their small businesses. They're the ones with the, you know, the late model luxury vehicles who want to get back to work so that they can put other people back to work.
Yeah.
So I'd be really interested in just seeing exactly the breakdown of where he gained support in those COVID districts, because, you know, everyone doesn't necessarily have the same incentives and perspectives about it.
I want to ask you a question. This is something I've been thinking about for literally months now. Obviously, you had the anti-lockdown protests. You have the people who think that, as you said earlier, that wearing a mask is as bad as being enslaved. So those people are, you know, they're going to Panera and they're shouting at people and all that. If Donald Trump, like the pandemic hits, let's say that he in theory had made the calculation that a pandemic killing 250,000 people is bad and that he should do something about it. And let's say he had come out in favor of mask wearing instantly. He always wore a mask, he told people to wear masks, he told his governors, you gotta encourage people to wear masks. If Fox News had picked that up and said, we're gonna support the president, we think wearing masks is awesome, social distancing is great. I know that you've reported in a number of states. I don't know how much that is with talking with the Trump supporters. Do you think that those anti-lockdown and anti-mask protests and the opposition, would it be as big? Like what percentage of those, I know this is all rough, it's speculative. What percentage of his base do you think was just looking to him to tell them what to do? And which are people who are like, seriously, government isn't supposed to be infringed on me in any way. So no matter what Trump said, they were gonna hate this thing.
Yeah, I mean, No, I haven't. That's not something that I've looked at. That's not something that I've studied. But I would assume that it's a fair amount. I think it's a critical mass of people who probably would be affected, or you know, who would have actually followed some norms of having you know, basic, like following basic health guidance if Donald Trump had done that. So you know, I could speculate as much as the next person. I think it would have helped more than you know, more than it would have hurt. But I, you know, who knows?
Yeah. I don't know. I just, considering the cost, considering how many lives have been lost, the continued economic damage of this, I think it's so important. I really do wonder. I know there was like CNN where it was asking some Trump fans outside of a Trump rally, like, you know, they gave you a mask, why don't you wear it? What if Trump were to say, and they said he can think whatever he wants, I'm not wearing the mask. I wonder how representative that is of Trump fans.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and now that I think about it, I think that again, this is something where people needed to find something to be mad at. So they needed to find a source of rage. So maybe their source of rage would have come from somewhere else, but this was an opportunity to have a grievance, because you know, all these Black Lives Matter protesters are getting, and I also wonder too, like if we didn't have Black Lives Matter protests and people talking about COVID disproportionately affecting Black people, I also wonder how big these anti-mask protests would have been. I think a lot of people got caught up in the spirit of just like a protest in general. And so I think even, you know, white voters here and abroad seeing, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests needed something to glom onto. So I think that's also a possibility there, where this, like the same way that you have, and this is me just speculating, the same way that you have these All Lives Matter protests, I think the anti-mask protest is a bit of a reaction to the criminal justice protests that we've been seeing over the summer.
I think you're 100% right. I think that everybody wants to be a part of a movement, and white conservatives want to feel like they're these rebels against the government. And so they found a very limited way to kind of do that while effectively following everything that Trump and the Republicans want them to do. I think you're 100% right. Yeah, if not for the BLM protests, maybe not. But yeah, they, so frustrating. So many lives lost needlessly. But anyway, we've come to the end of our time. Malaika, it was awesome to have you on the show today. Where can people watching find your work? Where can they follow you for your commentary going forward?
I'm a columnist at The Guardian and Gen Mag. I started a column, I didn't start a column, but I'm helming a column called Watching the Police. I recently went to the city of Atlanta to look at the DA race there and what's going on with the Rayshard Brooks case. So you can find me at Gen Mag. You can also find me at Guardian, where I do a monthly, bi-monthly column. And you can also follow me on Twitter, Malaika Jabali. And please watch the short film Left Out, which is looking at the crisis facing Black Midwesterners, bit.ly/leftout2020.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Great to have you on. Hope to talk to you again in the future soon.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.